Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
If you can get people protected and get an umbrella of what we call herd immunity, the level of infection is going to go very, very low down.
Following the herd to immunity, economist Tim Harford dives into the vaccination data and tells us how soon we may see an impact. Then,
oh, I've never felt pain like it. Because I couldn't be with him. I couldn't hold him. I couldn't stay.
The human factor. We hear the heartbreaking stories of grief in the time of COVID. And,
well, he was rather a spectacle. There was nothing ever like him on the American scene.
The complex life and times of Truman Capote. Director Ebes Burno gives us a riveting new look at this literary icon in his eye-opening documentary, The Capote Tapes. Plus,
in the aggregate, people who don't have to live under white supremacy are going to do better than those who do.
Charles Blow's bold idea, In the Devil You Know. The author tells our Hari Srinivasan why he's calling on black Americans to return to the South. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London, and it was a good day here in Britain as health officials celebrate promising new data on one of the major COVID vaccines. The new study by Oxford University shows that not only does their AstraZeneca vaccine prevent serious illness, but it also slows down transmission of the virus. And this is hugely important because for the first time, it answers that very question about stopping the spread of coronavirus. And what's more, data shows that one dose offers significant protection and that spacing out the two doses to 12 weeks does not minimize the vaccine's effectiveness and may even enhance it. Good news, as the COVID vaccine rollout is in a race with the virus itself. But poor nations are still not getting their fair share of shots, while variants and disinformation are spreading like wildfire. Here to discuss is Dr. Helen Rees. She's a renowned medical researcher who's joining us from Johannesburg, South Africa, and the British economist and FT journalist Tim Harford, who hosts the BBC Radio 4 series How to Vaccinate the World. He's also the author of The Data Detective, and both are joining me now. Welcome to the program. Tim Harford, let me ask you first, because you've been actually writing some of the good news about the vaccine rollout and what you foresee as the impact. How did you read and assess today's Oxford study? It hasn't yet been peer reviewed.
Yes, early days, but it is encouraging because everything I've been writing about the protective effects of the vaccine has made the conservative assumption that maybe it doesn't do anything to actually prevent the spread of infection. Maybe it only prevents people from getting sick, but still allows them to transmit. So any extra news that says it also prevents infections from passing from one person to another, which is what this new preliminary data suggests, that's extremely good news. That's a real bonus.
And quickly also on the spacing of the shots. I think this country is the only one who's officially spacing much wider than other countries. And the good news on that is that it may even enhance AstraZeneca's effectiveness. Of course, in the United States, Dr. Fauci is saying, rightly, that Pfizer and Moderna vaccines still need to be taken in their special three-week window. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we don't have good data, we don't have any data on the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines exploring what would happen if you delayed the booster shot. I think it's important to bear in mind that the reason that we had this 3 week or 4 week, depends on which vaccine, but this very short delay before the booster shot wasn't because people thought that is definitely the optimal timing. It's because we were in a hurry. We're trying to develop these vaccines at record speed, and you know, the vaccinologists have done this. It's an incredible achievement. So they wanted to test the shortest possible timing of the booster shot. So it doesn't mean the booster won't work after 6 weeks or after 10 weeks or after 12 weeks. It just means we don't know. Now, I happen to know the British government has just begun begun the process of starting a randomized trial into that. So ideally, we are going to start learning about the effects of spacing out the booster shot, and hopefully the rest of the world is going to find out from that.
Mm-hmm. Can I turn to you, Dr. Rees, in South Africa, because the South African variant, as it's being called, has come over here and elsewhere, and the medical profession and journalists and people are very concerned about it. What can you tell us about that? What do you know about it, and how is your vaccine rollout going in South Africa?
Well, starting with the variant, South Africa is very fortunate in that we have the capacity from the laboratory point of view to actually look at the virus and how it's been changing. And what was picked up at the end of last year was that the virus indeed was changing. The virus does change all the time, and it mutates all the time. But the question is, do these changes mean anything? And what has happened with the variant that emerged in South Africa is that the mutations that we've seen have affected the way that what's called the spike protein, and it has made the virus more transmissible, more easily transmitted from one person to another. What doesn't seem to have happened at the moment is it hasn't made it a more serious disease. It's already a serious disease, but it hasn't changed that pattern.
And what we've heard also, I mean, you know, you've had a second rather dramatic wave of COVID, but we also hear that today some of the restrictions are being lifted, that numbers are potentially going down. But we also hear from the WHO, and you chair an advisory vaccine commission for the region, that there is a major problem with getting vaccines to the developing world, Africa and elsewhere, which actually does have the vast majority of the world's population, whereas the 16% of the world's population, which is in the developing world, is getting the majority of the vaccines available right now. Tell us about whether you have enough vaccine and how that could impact, you know, the whole picture.
Well, I think that this is one of the biggest problems that we have. There isn't enough vaccine in the world at the moment, and there won't be enough vaccine in the world for the rest of the year to do what we would really like to do, which is vaccinate everybody. And one of the problems is we estimate that about 12.4 billion doses of vaccine will be manufactured in this year. But over about half of those have already been pre-purchased by rich countries. This means that the rest of the world, with the majority of the population, is going to have to try and divide up those vaccines. Poorer countries who are not in a position to do bilateral negotiations by themselves would otherwise be at the end of the queue. But there is a global initiative called COVAX. And the idea of COVAX, which was originated by WHO and various partners such as Gavi, was to actually say, how do we make sure that we get equitable access? We don't want the situation that we saw with pandemic flu, that, for example, the African region only got vaccines months after the pandemic was over. So COVAX aims to, on the one hand, enroll countries who want to purchase their vaccines through COVAX, and on the other hand, negotiate with all the manufacturers to both provide vaccines through the COVAX facility, but also negotiate prices, because you've got the advantage of a big marketplace on the one side and a secure marketplace. So the COVAX is proceeding, but COVAX is now having to compete to purchase vaccines with rich countries who are buying up the vaccines. So unless we actually rectify this, we are going to go back to the situation where poorer countries are going to have far fewer vaccines to access than richer countries. And just one more thing about this. Not only is this inequitable, but it's foolish in terms of stopping the pandemic. Because even if we were managed to immunize everyone in the US that wanted to have a vaccine, or everyone in the UK that wanted to have a vaccine, there will still be a sizable few who won't have the vaccine for one reason or another. And as long as you've got susceptible populations and you have other countries with no vaccines and circulating virus, that virus will find its way back into countries and back into susceptible populations.
Yep. Yep, that is a real problem on the horizon. Tim, I just want to ask you, though, to talk about what you're seeing and what you expect to see, because you've got the data, you've written the book, The Data Detective, and you're a data guy. And you've actually just recently written that there's a lot of kind of negative reporting about vaccines, about the impact, and people are expecting immediate impact. Tell us how you're sort of calculating when we will see, in this country, for instance, the impact of what the vaccine rollout is right now.
Yeah, I mean, Helen is absolutely right that the rollout is going to be very slow in poor countries and middle-income countries. I'd be very worried if I was in Brazil right now. But for countries that are in the privileged position of having access to a lot of vaccine, I think people are still saying, well, hang on, why are people dying in such large numbers still? Why aren't case counts coming down faster? And the difficulty is it takes time for vaccinations to turn into a lower death toll. So if you vaccinate somebody at the beginning of January, you may be going to prevent infections mid to late January. That prevents hospitalizations in early February, and then maybe prevents deaths in mid to late February. So even the people who were vaccinated right at the start of this year, we're not really going to see the benefit of that until Valentine's Day. And very few people were vaccinated that early. So that's the bad news. But the good news is that because the death toll has been so concentrated in very vulnerable groups, so in the UK, for example, more than two-thirds of people who've died so far have been either care homes or over 80. Because those groups are actually quite small, it doesn't take that many vaccines to protect them. And so there's this delay where nothing seems to be happening, and then suddenly I think it's reasonable to expect pretty rapid progress. And I think in the UK, which is in a privileged position, things are going to look very different at the end of February than they do at the start. And I really hope, Helen's absolutely right, I really hope that other countries are able to get a good number of vaccine doses quickly, because the sooner we start getting those doses into people, the sooner we'll see the beneficial effects, obviously.
So in the data that you analyze, you're basically seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
Absolutely. Deaths first, because the people who die are in the smallest group, the most vulnerable group. It takes a little longer to see the benefits in terms of, say, hospitalizations and ICU admissions, because those people are actually younger groups. They haven't been vaccinated yet. But it's coming. So it's not today, it's not tomorrow, but it really is coming.
Okay, so I want to ask you both, and I know you both are, you know, watching this, and again, Tim, you write about it, and you, Helen Rees, are a doctor, and you're concerned about it, the spread of misinformation. And we've heard, you know, Vice News wrote a really in-depth report recently on how the WHO has to deal with this, how UNICEF has to deal with this, how there is a really organized group of kind of rich to middle class people who are sending all this misinformation to much less well-to-do and less developed countries, and just scaring the bejesus out of people in terms of vaccine hesitancy and all the disinformation. I just want to ask you, Helen Rees, what you're seeing, for instance, in South Africa and what you're hearing in the region, where already, you know, Africans generally, because of colonial times and experiments, are concerned about vaccines from the West and the like.
Yes, and it is a global concern, and it's a concern in this region. WHO in 2019 said that actually vaccine hesitancy was one of the 10 biggest global health threats, and that was before we had a pandemic. It is really true now. For the African region, one of the things that triggered this was an unfortunate conversation between two French doctors, which suggested that Africa would be a place to come and do trials for vaccines, which started the conversation about are African countries going to be sites for guinea pigs for testing out vaccines. And from there have been many other rumors, and some of these are global rumors, about microchips in vaccines and so on, and trying to control, and 5G. All of those rumors that are global have also reached this region as well. I think the other thing, though, is trust, because in our region traditionally people do immunize their children, and there's been trust and confidence in vaccines by and large. one of the questions that people are legitimately asking, which is different to the misinformation and the rumors, is, are these vaccines safe and are they effective and were they developed too fast? And I think from the scientific point of view, it's up to us to explain the difference between doing something very fast and continuing to monitor when we roll out versus doing something that's reckless and dangerous and having unsafe vaccines. Because those questions are legitimate and need answering and people need reassuring. I think the good side, if there is a good side of what's going on with vaccines, and there's a good side to vaccines, but what's going on with the pandemic, is that it's actually made people talk about vaccines and the importance of vaccines. And I do think that the message is now getting out that we are going to battle to stop this pandemic unless we get vaccines out there and we get high vaccine coverage. And that message is probably one of the most powerful messages. But the misinformation and the use of social media is absolutely rife in this region as well, and in South Africa.
So, Tim, and again, you've written a cover story about wishful thinking and how people are, you know, kind of why they allow themselves to be so fooled. You also, as I said in your book, The Data Detective, talk about the positive impact of learning statistics and learning about how to use data. So why is it, what have you discovered about why seemingly educated people in the developed world and elsewhere are so fooled and so willing to be fooled by absurd conspiracy theories and the like? This is beyond the kind of legitimate concerns that Dr. Rees talks about.
Yes, I mean, Dr. Rees is absolutely right to make a sharp distinction between the committed anti-vaxxers who are, you know, very well organized and believe some very strange things, and the large minority of people who are hesitant and want reassurance. It is extraordinary the things that we can convince ourselves to believe. One of the themes that I explore in The Data Detective is really how I can give you all the technical information that you like. I can you know, try and advance your expertise in statistics, but fundamentally, if you want to fool yourself, if you get yourself tied up in, you know, you fall into the wrong crowd, or you really start to passionately believe in something, those emotions are going to override almost any facts or evidence that I can offer. And I mean, the simple principle I would say to people, I say the three C's. So it's calm, it's context, and curiosity. Calm, just try and get over your emotional reaction to whatever information you're being presented with. A lot of the information that we see is designed to make us fearful or angry because that wins, it gets engagement, gets clicks. Just be calm. The moment you've noticed your emotions, you're in a position to think more clearly. Second, just get context. Don't believe something that just circulates on Facebook that, you know, with some sort of crazy graphic and there's no context, there are no credible sources, there are no links. If someone wants to communicate properly with you, they're going to give you the context, give you the sources, put something into perspective. And finally, curiosity. If we view statistical claims as a way of finding out about the world, that's the right frame of mind. If we view them as ways to win a particular argument, then, you know, we're not making ourselves smarter, and we're not really helping anybody else either.
Really valuable lessons. Tim Harford, thank you so much. And Dr. Helen Rees, also from South Africa, thank you. Now, as for the human factor, of course, the unfathomable loss of life around the world is taking place in the shadows, with people mostly dying alone and also grieving alone. Correspondent Phil Black spends some time with some of the bereaved families here in the UK who are trying their best to pay proper tribute to their loved ones.
Like all of us now, Trish and Peter Skinner find comfort in family video calls. Here they're connecting to dozens of people across England and the US.
Your boys are so grown up.
For a brief moment, there's joy seeing all those loving faces. But the feeling is quickly crushed as the screen shows why they've come together. They're watching live images from a grey, windy cemetery near England's southern coast, where Trisha's father is being buried. Herbert John Tate died from COVID-19. He was almost 104, remembered as the strong-willed patriarch who held his family together for generations.
That was Grandad, and I loved him.
The pandemic means only a small number of young people can be there to mourn him.
He's once more with his sweethearts.
Trish can only watch and listen from home. A shaky image on a small screen is a limited window to the ceremony honouring her father's long, meaningful life. And then it's over.
It was a beautiful funeral, hey, really lovely.
But for a grieving daughter who longs to be with family, it's not enough.
The saddest thing now is that we're all going to leave.
Grief in the time of COVID is made worse by loneliness.
Can't possibly be the same. There's no interaction physically. And that's the biggest thing that's missing during this terrible time.
He was like my best friend. Felt like I'd known him forever.
Edwina Fitzpatrick also knows that pain. She and her husband, Nick Devlin, both caught the virus. Nick deteriorated quickly.
I wheeled him through with one of the nursing staff through the hospital. And we went in. And that's the last I saw of him. Waving through window. And blowing kisses at each other.
Edwina was abruptly alone with her grief. Locked down in the home they'd shared. Surrounded by evidence of their life together.
How dark did it get for you?
Oh, I did think very strongly and seriously about committing suicide that first weekend.
Instead, Edwina chose to live, to ensure Nick's first novel was published, and to help others. She set up COVID Speakeasy, video support groups for those experiencing the pandemic's unique power to inflict trauma through grief and isolation.
We don't want to tell people just how terrible we're feeling, both physically and mentally.
I've never felt pain like it, because I couldn't be with him. I couldn't hold him. I couldn't say that. Sorry. Couldn't say bye to him.
I mean, it was. Sammy Miller is describing what it was like really losing her father to COVID-19.
Yeah. Happy birthday!
This was David Miller only a few months before he died. 66 and healthy, loving and loved. Sammy says everything about grieving him is harder because of the pandemic.
I'm waiting for bereavement counselling. Because I don't know what. Had to live without my dad.
To find closure, she turned to London St. Paul's Cathedral. For centuries, a building focused on remembering loss and sacrifice. Sammy added her father's image to the cathedral's permanent online memorial, a project to help people cope with the specific challenges of confronting grief in the time of COVID.
I just think it's a beautiful thing that St. Paul's Cathedral's done. And I just want to keep his memory alive.
He's not just a number.
He's not just a number. He's my dad.
David Miller, Nick Devlin, John Tate. Just three among the millions lost. A tiny sample from the pandemic's infinite pool of grief.
Really moving reporting there by Phil Black from the real front lines of this virus, which puts into perspective the good news that we've been talking about on this program today about the vaccines. And we're going to turn now to one of the most enigmatic literary figures of the modern era, the American author Truman Capote. His book, In Cold Blood, and also Breakfast at Tiffany's were blockbusters. And now he's the subject of a new biodoc. Here's a clip from the trailer of the Capote tapes.
Well, he was rather a spectacle. There was nothing ever like him on the American scene.
In those days, there were very few people who were out.
He had a special life and he was going to live in a special way.
He really thought of a way to make the world you live in art.
Won't you join me?
We all think of Audrey Hepburn now. And of course, you read the book and it's completely different.
In Cold Blood is what I call the nonfiction novel.
In Cold Blood propels him into a world of achievements.
His intellect made him a complete original.
Truman's going to be read by generations.
the extraordinary Truman Capote, and the film centers around his unfinished novel, Answered Prayers, which sparked his decline and his ostracization by the New York socialites he so coveted. It marks Ibs Berno's directorial debut as well, and he's joining me now to talk about it. Ibs Berno, welcome to the program. Yes, he's a very colorful, important, iconic figure. But why did you decide to take on Truman Capote? What was it?
Well, thank you for having me, Christiane. You know, I was actually in the midst of reading a book many years ago that was on Bill Paley and the founding of CBS. And when I finished the tome, the two most interesting people to me were Truman Capote and Bill's wife and Truman's best friend, Babe. And that sent me back down a rabbit hole of studying Truman and, of course, rewatching the two feature films. Obviously, there had been Capote with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Infamous with Toby Jones. But both really focused on a slice of Truman's life. They focused really on the writing of In Cold Blood. And as I read more and as I researched, I felt like his was a life that had not fully been mined for what could be learned today. I mean, he was an extraordinary character, and there was so much about him that just hadn't been told, particularly in those films.
So what for you is the most revealing thing that you found out? I mean, so much that you wanted to discover about him.
I think the most revealing thing for me was his real desire to have a family, and the fact that in an era where it was illegal to be an openly gay person in many places around the world, Truman was both openly gay, very famous, very clever, but he managed to create a family for himself by more or less adopting the daughter of one of his last lovers. And she moved in with him around the age of 13, and he raised her, and she considers him very much her father. And that for me was an extraordinary angle about him, because so often we hear about, you know, the clever writer, the mean person, the tiny terror, but that story and meeting her and delving into that piece of the story really put him in a different context for me.
And it showed the warmth of his heart, actually. And that'll be interesting when we talk about essentially what happened to him at the very end with Answered Prayers. But I want to start by asking you about, you know, what you profile as well, Other Voices, Other Rooms. I think that was his first major work. It was written in the 20s and it caused quite a stir. It was kind of a coming out novel. It had a very provocative picture of Truman Capote on the cover. And I think one reviewer called it, you know, like the fairy version of Huckleberry Finn.
Yes. Truman was always provocative. And it showed through in that first novel, certainly, which was, I think, Jay McInerney called it a bit of the fairy Huck Finn in the doc as well. But Truman was someone who, from an early age, dared to be who he was. And I think part of that was he couldn't run away from who he was, his size, his voice. He was also an orphan, and he embraced his outness, and he used it less as something to be afraid of and really as a way forward. And I think for him, certainly getting to New York City and being able to invent, you know, not even reinvent, but invent himself as a small Southern boy coming from Alabama was an extraordinary, you know, it's an extraordinary creation. Part of Truman is about self-creation, mm-hmm. and his works often really focus on what it is to create yourself and change your identity from someone in the past to someone incredibly interesting and new.
So I wonder if that all crystallizes in one of his most famous books, Breakfast at Tiffany. So, you know, his mother was known as a courtesan. I'm not sure quite exactly what that means. But also, as you say, she abandoned him. She never accepted that he was gay. And he was raised by two aunts. And in Breakfast at Tiffany's, the film, as you say in your documentary, is totally a candy floss version of his book, which was much, much grittier. Tell me a little bit about that and whether it kind of was a commentary on his own mother as well.
I definitely think it was a commentary on his own mother. It was also, you know, Truman's style of writing from a young age, I think it's fair to say there's a great story of him being 8 or 9 years old and writing a story that won a prize in the newspaper, and it was called Mrs. Busybody. And it was about a terribly curious, rather nosy woman who sat on the porch in town and was always tending to everyone else's business. And of course, it was really based on the mother of his best friend, Harper Lee. And Truman got in terrible trouble for it. But he was always a person who wrote what he saw, and he wrote what he knew. And Breakfast at Tiffany's, it's certainly elements of his mother. It's also an amazing story of self-creation. I mean, the story itself is rather difficult in the sense of there isn't a love story. And it is a person who is, you know, more or less a call girl or an escort who is making her way in New York. And the male character in the story is also, you know, rather decidedly in many ways gay and lonely. It's two lonely people that are finding their way. And I think Truman certainly wrote from the heart. His mother was very similar to that. She made her way to New York and made a life for herself. But he wrote from experience. He wrote what he knew and what he saw. He just couldn't help himself.
Yeah, and I'm just imagining Audrey Hepburn and Holly Golightly, and it definitely wasn't the version in the book, much, much grittier in the book. And what about In Cold Blood? Because, you know, you talk and you get people to talk about, you know, how he found out about that grisly murder, how he went down there, but also how he tried to influence the sentencing of the killers.
Yes, I mean, you know, Truman had worked on the book for almost 6 years, and it needed to have, as you know, he needed it to have an ending. He needed it not to just go on from, you know, trial to trial and stay of execution to stay of execution. He actually needed it to have an ending, and he didn't end up having any influence, certainly, but and I think that's something that tortured him, because his success was very much built on the deaths of two people. And while they weren't innocent, certainly he developed close relationships with both of them, and very close relationship with Perry. And so it is one of the things that made him a huge international star. But it's also one of the things that he carried with him for the rest of his life and weighed very heavily on him.
Well, his fellow very, very famous novelist, Graham Greene, said after that, you know, if anybody had a splinter of ice in their heart, it was Truman Capote. And it contrasts so much with his sort of presence on the social scene. You know, he gave that very famous, and everybody knows about it, black and white ball in New York. And there's a clip in the film about it. I just want to play it.
All the ladies are wearing masks on Truman Capote's orders, and the inky wretches of the press on his orders also are being kept at a discreet distance from the guests outside this door. The people arriving here have come from Rome, from Hollywood, Venice, Paris, Washington, San Francisco, London, just to go to a party. 540 or so have dressed and coiffed and masked themselves and presented themselves at the plaza for the honor of serving themselves at Truman Capote's bar and saying they were here.
So, Ebes, how did he pull that off? And literally, you know, it was a who's who of as it was pointed out, of all the top socialites of the world, frankly. How did he pull that off? What was that all about for him?
You know, I think a lot of that was, it was also his coming out. I mean, he had finished In Cold Blood. He had, you know, Breakfast at Tiffany's had been before. And he, of course, he couched it as if it was a black and white ball honoring Kay Graham, who was, you know, the publisher of the Washington Post. But the reality was, it was Truman's moment to shine. It was the little boy from rural Alabama had actually made it to the center, not just of New York, but to the center of the world. And that assembling for him was a very defining moment to say, I did it, I'm here, I've arrived. But unfortunately after it, I think he found himself kind of looking in the mirror saying, now what?
Well, now what was then came Answered Prayers, which was, his unfinished novel, apparently. We'll talk a little bit about that. But he thought that he could, you know, change a few names and write down all the secrets of all the grand dames who he met. Here he is, before his decline and before his fall, talking to the great talk show host Dick Cavett about it. This is a clip from your documentary.
Don't you have a book about to appear now? For a couple of years, we've been waiting for Answered Prayers. Mm. And have you turned it over to the publisher yet?
No. I refer to it now as my posthumous novel. Because either I'm going to kill it or it's going to kill me. It's just sort of like an endless Chinese dinner. It grows and grows. I can't seem to get to the bottom of it.
Wow, it was prescient, wasn't it? Because it wasn't published and it did cause a massive backlash. Tell me about it. What's the end of this story is really that.
Yes, the end of this story is really that. And it's also a moment which I wanted to point out in the documentary. It's also a moment in for all of us and for the viewer, hopefully, to also address what addiction can also do and the effects of addiction. You know, it doesn't go lost on me. It wasn't lost on me working on this, that because, as I said earlier, Truman always wrote what he knew and what he saw. And when you think about Breakfast at Tiffany's, you had all of these women raising their hands saying, oh, that was based on me. And yet when you read the story, you thought, oh, it's a bit gritty for someone to raise their hand and say it's based on me. But the writing was so beautiful. And as Norman Mailer says, he wrote the best sentences. I think by the time he really was digging into Answered Prayers, he was heavily addicted to drugs and alcohol. And there was a slide effect happening. And the work wasn't as strong because his faculties weren't as strong, and he was feeling a lot of pressure in terms of having $1 million advance and delivery. But it was an era; it's an era of his life when he was drinking a great deal, addicted to prescription drugs as well as other drugs. So I often think that he was basing what he was doing off of what he knew before, off of the writing he had done before. But unfortunately, his faculties weren't quite up to it. And so it's not at all Proustian, unfortunately. It's entertaining, certainly, but it was far too revealing and it didn't have any nuance. And it got him completely locked out of the society, of the black and white ball society that he had spent his entire life craving and fighting to get into.
A sad end to his life there. Ibs Berno, thank you so much indeed. And the Capote Tapes is available to watch now on digital platforms in the UK. And of course, it's releasing in the United States this summer. The New York Times op-ed columnist and author Charles Blow has penned a new book. It's called The Devil You Know, A Black Power Manifesto. It's a roadmap for overturning white supremacy, he says. He has moved to Atlanta, Georgia, after living in New York for 25 years. And he's now proposing that other black Americans up north do the same to boost their political power in key southern cities. Here's our Hari Srinivasan talking to him about why now and how it would work in practice.
Christiane, thanks. Charles Blow, thanks for joining us. The majority of the book is outlining an idea that is not a thought experiment for you. You're living it. Explain the proposition.
The proposition is simply to return to the places where you were majorities or large percentages of the population to consolidate political power. Before the Great Migration, 90% of all black people lived in the American South. At the end of the Civil War, three southern states were majority black. Another three were within 4 percentage points of being majority black. Every southern state had large black populations. If black people had not migrated, which is a big if, and if there was still the passage of the civil rights legislation and the voting rights legislation, another big if, it is conceivable that black people today would control up to 14 Senate seats. They could control more electoral college votes than New York State and California combined. If they voted over that same period the way they vote today, there would not have been a Republican president in the last 50 years. That would mean that the Supreme Court would look completely different. I don't think there's a justice on it who was appointed over 50 years ago. This is a, you know, it would have been a major shift in power, and it can still be. The only thing that Black people have to do, and not even all of them have to do this, but large numbers have to do what many, what smaller numbers are already doing, which is to return to the South.
You want people to come back to the South in order to be able to exercise their political power better than what they have in the North, right?
Absolutely. There is no real power, political power, that Black people have in the Northern states.
How is that possible? We've
what does that mean?
This is one of the premises of the migration out of the South was, you know what? It's going to be better in the North. How is it that they don't have political power in New York or in California or in Minnesota?
Because they're all diluted. So the Black percentage of California is about 5%. Black percent of New York is about 15%, same in Illinois. So you are not going to deliver a state. You can be the additive group when white people basically split down the middle. But you can't deliver a state on your own. You can't elect a senator on your own. New York has never had a Black senator. Black New Yorkers have never delivered New York. It's still going to be blue whether Black people are there or not. And that is with New York City having 2 million Black people in it, more Black people than any other city in America. And yet they can't produce, right? So they can't elect a Black governor. There's only been one Black governor, and that was because he was lieutenant governor when the actual governor got caught in a prostitution scandal. No Black senators. The last 2 million people in the city, you've only had one Black mayor in the entire history of the city of New York, and that was 30 years ago. And behind him came Rudy Giuliani, who used racist tactics, and Michael Bloomberg, who was a champion of stop and frisk.
You know, at the surface, when someone looks at an idea like this, they're going to say, well, this is sort of the new Garvey. Is he calling for Black supremacy? Is he giving up on integration? Is this about self-segregation?
Well, I would turn that glove inside out. For the last 90 years, every state in America except Hawaii has been majority white. No one says that that's a problem for integration or diversity. Right now, as we speak, 7 states in America are 90%+ white. Is that not white supremacy or white majority or overwhelming? Is that not a problem for diversity? There are 40 million Black people. There are only 10 million people in the entire, if you collect all those people in those 7 states together, it's 10 million people. There are 4 times as many Black people in America than in those 7 states. But Black people don't control only one Senate, black senator, 2 Senate seats. Ossoff was also elected by a coalition where Black people were the majority. But how is that possible? Those people represent, what, about 3% of the American population, but they control 4 senators, and they're 90%+ white? People can't ask me questions about whether or not this is a problem about racial concentration and racial power until they deal with those 7 states.
Well, let's talk a little bit about sort of, let's say, brass tacks, right? So let's say, okay, all right, I'm signing up. Now I'm thinking to myself, what sort of incentives are there? What sort of economic opportunity is in the South? I mean, have we kind of frozen our idea of what the South is? Because one of the hesitations that people have is, I don't want to go to the South. Well, it's more racist there. There's less jobs there, et cetera. You've been diving into the data for all your research. What did you find?
Well, Forbes does a list, I think, every year. Definitely, I took was 2018, but that's when I started writing the book. Places where the Black middle class is thriving. Half of that list is cities in the South. When researchers look at where Black-owned businesses are most concentrated, the number one region for that is the Southeast. When you look at real gains in median family income, the South ranks at the top of that list, on and on and on. The Black middle class is actually thriving in the South. The other thing is about racism. Well, I ask people at the Project Implicit, which studies implicit bias during population. They've done like hundreds of thousands of these online tests. I've asked them to cut their data, to show me racial bias, what they track as anti-Black, pro-white biases. Show me those biases by region and by race. Very simple request. It was surprising to even them. There was no difference in the amount of racial bias among white people from the South and those in the North and those in the Midwest. None.
You know, there's a quote in your book that says, "The supposed egalitarianism of northern cities is more veneer than core doctrine. It's a flimsy disguise for racism and white supremacy that diverges from its southern counterparts only in style, not substance." Explain that.
Well, when I look at the militarizing of the police, that is a northern and western city phenomenon, the supposedly liberal cities. Right. The you got the SWAT team from California because they were responding in part to the Black Panthers. That was the first SWAT team. If I look at stop and frisk, that didn't start in Greensboro or Birmingham or Jackson, Mississippi or Little Rock, Arkansas. That starts in New York, exported to California and Los Angeles and Chicago. If I look at every police department right now that is under a consent decree with the Department of Justice because they have misbehaved and have violated people's civil rights, only two of those are in the South. All the rest are in northern and western cities. The data, I don't understand why the people don't actually look at the data. When I look, you know, people look at incarceration rate. Mass incarceration is a huge issue for a lot of African Americans. They always point to the South and say they incarcerate a lot of people. Yeah, but they also incarcerate a lot of white people. What you have to do is look at it and say, of the number of Black people that you have, what percentage of those do you incarcerate? And when you do it per capita, the Southern states rarely even rank. Vermont is at the top of that list for Black men.
You brought up Vermont. That's interesting. In the book, you point out that Vermont is the result today of a rather drastic and short migration that began there, not dissimilar to what you're talking about, really, from an article in Playboy.
Absolutely. And that was part of my inspiration for this book because it worked so well. And during the Vietnam War, early 70s, young hippies were liberals. I don't want to call all of them hippie, but a lot of them were. That was not a derogatory term. Were protesting against the war, protesting against the way Nixon was executing the war. But he was not budging. He was he continued to execute it the way he wanted to. Two young Yale law students wrote an article in the Yale Law Review that said, you know, you can't, you're not going to get anywhere this way. You can't have any kind of armed revolution, but you can do this thing we call radical federalism, which is to basically go move to a small state, take it over. One of the smallest states, Vermont, it doesn't take as many people, move. And it kind of languished there for a few months until a writer picked it up and wrote an article in Playboy. And yes, people used to read Playboy for the articles because there were a lot of great writers writing in Playboy. And he wrote an article under the title "Take Over Vermont." And after that, thousands, tens of thousands of young white hippies grabbed their things and moved to Vermont. And some of them didn't have places to stay, slept in the fields. They created communes, but they transformed Vermont from one of the more conservative states in the union to now it is the most, one of the most liberal states in America. It is where you get a Bernie Sanders. It is where Barack Obama gets his highest percentage of the white vote in 2008. They basically changed Vermont from New Hampshire into Vermont. And that is the power of migration.
We are not in the era of Jim Crow. We've repealed many of those rules. Why do we need now this influx of Black Americans to move to these places? And what impact will that have? Isn't the system working?
It's not working. We have not repealed those rules. We've forced the people who want the same rules to reinvent them in a more elegant form. We still have massive voter suppression. It's just in a different form. It's not a poll tax or it's not a literacy test, but it is, you know, all of the things that is happening right now in Georgia in response to the fact that Black people were the majority of that coalition that delivered the state for Democrat. And now they're introducing bill after bill in the state legislature here in Georgia, trying to say, get rid of no reason early voting, or require two forms of voter ID. Anything that they can do to make it more difficult for people to cast a ballot is exactly what they're going to do. And they know, and I know, and you know, that that disproportionately affects Black people, brown people, college students, and the elderly who are poor. It is not that these things have gone away. And as long as you have state legislatures that are hostile to you, and that exists in many ways across the country, hostile to you, you'll never be free.
Charles, you're also making right now in your last answer the case against moving to Atlanta or to Georgia, saying, hey, even if we have more Black people here, doesn't mean racism stops. That doesn't mean the attempts to disenfranchise me stop.
I don't think that's an argument against it at all. If I'm not promising anybody a utopia. If racial majorities and control of state power guaranteed utopias, every white person in America would be prospering, because for the last 90 years, they've controlled the majority of states of Hawaii. But they're not all prospering. There's still crime. There's still poverty. There's still income inequality. There's still food insecurity. Those seven states that I mentioned to you, 90%+ white, surely all those white people are prospering. No, they're not. They're human beings. They have problems that accompany the human condition. If you go to the South and by chance have a Black majority, you will also still have the problems that accompany the human condition. There's no such thing as a utopia when human beings are involved. It is just that in the aggregate, people who don't have to live under white supremacy are going to do better than those who do. And this is the only way for you to not have a space in this country, legally, constitutionally, where you do not have to live under a system of white supremacy.
Look, are you assuming that all Black people will vote the same way? I mean, look at the elections in the last two cycles. I mean, you had large numbers of Hispanics, Asians, Black Americans vote for Trump.
I am not assuming that at all. And what I am very careful to say and want to be very clear about in all my interviews is Black power is not political party power. I am not advocating Black power for Democrats or so the Democrats will have more of an advantage, or Black power so the Republicans can get a foothold. Black power is for Black people to not live under white supremacy, whatever form that takes. You know, 100 years ago, if you walked into any room in America, the majority of the Black people in that room would have been Republicans. Democrats were the party of the racist, clear and simple, no doubt about it, the Klan and everything else. But the Democratic Party reformed itself, changed itself, and Black people over the course of a century forgave the fact that they were the party of the Klan. You could have a future in which the Republican Party no longer sees a viable path to a national election and then starts to court Black people the same way that the Democratic Party started to do. I don't know what the future holds on the political party front. Right now, the Republican Party, in my opinion, courts the races, which is a non-starter for Black people. They just can't get with it. But I don't know if that's be the future, but Black power exists separately from a total alignment with any particular party.
So lay out the distinctions between your proposal, which you say is based on anti-racism, pro-Blackness. How is that distinct from Black supremacy? How is the entire idea not racist on its face?
Again, I go back to this idea, like, how is it that no one is saying that this is white supremacy, that you have every single state except Hawaii, this majority white right now? And that is not a fluke. That is by design. People will run out of those states where they were from by white terror. They had majorities there. There were times when Native Americans were majorities of what would become states. And they were chased west. There was a time when some of the western states had much larger percentages of Hispanic people. That was kind of their territory. So the idea that we, the American people, by design, chased people using white terror into spaces where now none of them have, or majority of the spaces where they would have been majorities anyway, that seems to be not a problem. But advocating that Black people might one day be one percentage point over 50% in a state, not 90 plus percent like those seven white states that I was telling you about, just 1% over 50, that freaks people out. We have to interrogate why that sounds like a problem to people.
Charles Blow, the book is called The Devil You Know. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
And that is it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.